Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Last week, we featured an interview with Michael Bell, whose son was shot and killed by a Kenosha police officer after a routine traffic stop in November of 2004. His search for the truth of what happened to his son has spanned over two decades. Today, we talk with the police officer who pulled the trigger, resulting in young Michael Bell's death. Albert Brian Gonzalez is retired from the Kenosha Police Department after 25 years. While still employed by the city, he wrote a self-published book entitled A Fateful 2 Minutes, which detailed his perspective of the incident which resulted in Bell's death. He agreed to talk with me under the condition that Bell's name specifically would not be mentioned during the interview. He's been sued in the past, although that suit was dismissed. Gonzalez is now a volunteer police chaplain with the Billy Graham Rapid Response Team and host of the Ministry of the Badge podcast, inspired by the book of the same name. Here is our conversation. Did you always want to be a police officer?
You know, I had been wanting to be a police officer probably since I was about around 8 to 10 years old. I was actually inspired. I was down in San Antonio, Texas years ago, and I was at a festival. And I had very bad asthma way back then. And I had an asthma attack that I just about died from. I was with my cousin. We were down in Texas. Of course, I'll never forget this. And I started to pass out. My asthma was so severe back then. My cousin, little guy, picks me up and walks me over to a police officer that's standing in the roadway, and I can vaguely remember, but I remember it being handed to this police officer. This police officer is holding me in his arms. I'm a 10-year-old kid. I didn't probably weigh that much at that time. And he's running with me down the street, and I could see his badge in my face just kind of bobbing up and down. I can kind of see the officer, and he brings me over to a first aid station. They get me over into an ambulance, and they take me to the hospital. And I was with my cousin. I went with my parents at that time. So my parents eventually came to the hospital, and I remember it was kind of like, remember the show Emergency?
Yeah, sure.
So it's funny. I didn't want to be a firefighter, but I did like those too. But when I was in the hospital, they prepped me. I was okay after that, you know, all the things that they did back then. And that officer and those ambulance guys, they all came to see me in the hospital. It was very inspirational, I guess you can say. And that's what started my journey. I saw that and I thought, I want to do that. And I felt like a draw to be able to do that or go into the military. And actually, I wanted to do both, but I couldn't get in the military because I had asthma very bad. So,
how'd you end up with the Kenosha Police Department?
So Kenosha is the town I grew up in. I was born in another state, Army brat. Came back to Kenosha, spent all my time from probably a year old all the way till now in the city of Kenosha. And I had gone to different places and applied, but I applied to Kenosha because that was the town I grew up in. So to give back to the community that I grew up in would have been, you know, prime. So I tried a couple different times to get on the Kenosha Police Department, and my second time, actually going into my third time, I think that's how it worked, I got on to the Kenosha Police Department.
How did you approach your job as a police officer?
When I went to be a police officer, that need to serve, and like I said, knowing that police officer way back then, I kind of approached it in the sense of, I want to go in there and help people. And I think every police officer starts out the same way. When you ask them, why did you go to be a cop? Well, I want to help people. And I remember at the interview, well, you help people working at McDonald's. You help people working at different places. But it was something different. And that need to help, little did I realize what that would actually translate into when I started to study and then actually became a police officer. All the different hats and all the different styles of the way you patrol or whatever all come into play. And then it starts to manifest itself And I say manifests itself in about the 5 to 7 year mark, you start to realize really what this job is all about. It's not a job at all. It's something you're called to do.
A vocation?
A vocation, yeah. I actually call it a calling, and I'll explain a little bit more. Because what you're able to do as a police officer is very unique. To compartmentalize all of the different traumas that you see throughout your career and still be able to process everyday life as you live it, it's a unique disposition. I think only akin to maybe those of a pastor. And I've actually been told that by a pastor when I went through the chaplaincy program. He had made mention to me, he had said, there was a group of officers in the particular class I was in. And this pastor, it like struck him midway through the class, and he stood up and he came down, talked to us on one of our breaks. He says, I never realized how much pastors and police officers are the same type of people. I've never realized what kind of a calling you guys have on your life. And that's when it hits you. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So what was the camaraderie among that department? I mean, is it different, do you think? Does it vary from police department to police department? Or is it when cops get together, there's a certain brotherhood?
Yeah, very much so. And I think it comes from, just like any military person, it comes from that shared experiences of the different traumas that you experience. Cops, when they talk to other cops, they just know, right? It could be amongst news people. It could be amongst, you know, many people. You just kind of know. So the camaraderie is like with any other organization, except we're all under a common veil of that shared trauma. There's no other way to explain it. And being a cop, you view the world in such a different light because you see things most people won't ever see in their lifetime.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Like any other individual, an officer is going to be on the radio screaming for help. And when that happens, it's no holds barred. Get to these guys as quickly as you can.
Former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez talks about police protocol in a critical incident.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez. What happens when a police officer is involved in a situation where they call for backup and you hear that on your radio?
Oh, wow. So a call for backup, depending on the situation, there's a common call for backup. But hey, I need another squad. I'm at this location for whatever reason. You get called for backup to say somebody who's wanted, you know, so they'll send you another squad. And then there's the call for backup that you get where officers are in danger, screaming on the radio. We're taught as officers, you can be taught all the things you want. So we're taught how to handle ourselves on the radio. You're taught how to do everything. But when a situation arises that is very, very, man, life-changing, like any other individual, an officer is going to be on the radio screaming for help. And when that happens, it's no holds barred. Get to these guys as quickly as you can.
And this goes back to this brotherhood.
Yes.
So what's the protocol? When you arrive at a situation like that, is there a protocol? If you know that a fellow officer could potentially be in danger, are there things that you're taught to do or not do under those circumstances?
I mean, so anything you're taught, I mean, let's face it, there's the book way of doing things, and then there's the way things evolve when it starts to happen. All of it centers around what you're taught. However, when the situation goes into areas that aren't exactly written in a book, you're then acting into that situation. So I don't know if there's a protocol per se. First of all, you got to get there and you got to make sure that the other officers are safe. Whatever is happening, you're going to assist in that situation. And whatever comes of that situation, you're reacting at the time to what exactly is going on. So every situation can be different. So when you do go to a situation, I don't know if there's protocol per se, like, you know, Section 1 do this, Section 2 do this. There is how, like I said, there's how you're taught and then what happens when the situation is happening.
How many times in your career were you faced with a critical incident?
Oh, geez. Critical incident meaning what?
Something that is a matter of life and death.
Oh, life and death for a citizen, life and death for a police officer. I couldn't tell you. I wouldn't know. You're confronted with so many of those type of situations that, I don't know. I couldn't give you a number.
All right. What about how many times, or can you even count how many times, you were in a situation where a fellow officer needed backup because his or her life may have been in the balance?
Oh, geez. Probably a handful of times where a situation would become, yeah, that bad. I remember one particular situation where a sergeant was on the radio screaming for help. He was fighting with somebody, and I remember after the situation, he's like, man, if you wouldn't have come, he says, I heard those sirens, and I knew the cavalry was coming. That's usually how we said it. And he took it as a situation that he was about to lose big time. And you could tell on the radio, you know, there was something going on, and everybody tries to remain calm, right? But when I got to that situation and it was resolved, he just not quite broke down, but you could tell he had it. He was to his point of, man, if you wouldn't have come, it could have gone a whole different way.
That's interesting that you said it's like the cavalry is coming.
Yeah.
Like an old John Wayne movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You wrote about a critical incident in a book. We mentioned it, A Fateful 2 Minutes. Mm-hmm. And that described an incident where you shot and killed somebody. Mm-hmm. That suspect was being taken into custody. Mm-hmm. Why did you write that book?
You know, it started out as not intending to write a book. It was more cathartic to write down, to kind of get on paper all that was that I was feeling about the situation, I guess you could say. And all that, yeah, it was just cathartic, just to kind of get it out, right? To like, because when you go through a situation like that, it's traumatic enough that it leaves an imprint on your mind that you've got to get it out. You can't keep it in. So, you know, I'm a man of prayer. I'm a Christian man. I've been a Christian since I've been 8 years old. And I prayed about it and thought about it and talked about it and shared with my wife about it and maybe a few other family members or whatever. But it was just, Write it down.
Had anybody recommended that you do that, a pastor or a therapist, and say, you know what, Brian, this was a really traumatic incident. You need to put it down on paper just to kind of get it out?
I can't think of any one particular person that said to me, hey, write this down or whatever. I think it's just something, and maybe I'd heard it over the years. I mean, I don't really remember the exact, but I just remember writing it down was cathartic. Maybe at some point I had talked to somebody, you know, whatever it could have been, but I don't recall anybody offhand.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
That quote is the way that I could describe that overwhelming sense of surviving a fight or flight experience.
Former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez reflects on why he wrote the words yay wahoo when shooting and killing a man being taken into custody.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez. How did the incident change your life?
It really hits you when you're in a situation such as this. And the dichotomy of taking a person's life at the same time being a Christian person. I remember at the time specifically, and I think I wrote about it in my book, I spoke with my youth pastor, who had been my youth pastor back when I was 14 years old. And I went to him and I said, do you know what? I understand now how David felt, young David.
You're talking David and Goliath.
David and Goliath, correct. Because to know that taking a man's life at the same time being a servant of God and then knowing that that situation is okay. That's the only way I can describe it.
Did it haunt you at all?
Haunt me in what way?
Emotionally, I would think that it, you know, after being in a situation where somebody lost their life and you pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
I would think it's a nightmare situation.
Yeah, it's a dichotomy to say the least to know, but it didn't haunt me. But you picture it, you can see it, you know that it happened to you. But under that stressful situation, and being that you're in a fight and flight situation, once you come out of that, you're like, oh, man. But the strange part about it is you had to do that and take somebody's life in order to come out of it. The only way I can explain that situation is when you talk to veterans who go to war. And I've talked to many people who have been to war, and they will tell me about a story, one maybe story in particular that they can remember. And you can empathize with them because you understand when your life is in that kind of a stressful situation and you feel like your life or the life of someone else is going to be taken, and then the way to get out of that situation or what's going to bring about the end of that situation in the immediacy is the taking of another life. There's no other way to explain it other than that. And that's kind of why I wrote the book, too, on top of the cathartic, because I wanted to show that what you have been through and what you have done as an officer who takes this step. Yep, it's a strange situation to be in. However, what you're going to experience after that is normal.
I'm going to quote one thing out of the book.
Absolutely.
And it's where you describe what was going in your mind mm-hmm. in the seconds after you fired that gun. Mm-hmm. And this is a direct quote. It says, "Yay, wahoo, I did it. I cheered inside my head as though I scored the winning touchdown." What did you mean when you wrote those words?
So that quote is the way that I could describe that overwhelming sense of surviving a fight or flight experience. And I didn't realize that until later on when I had read a couple other books. And when I started reading the books and I started listening to and then reading how others, when they attributed the situation they survived, like, this is a strange dichotomy. How does one part of your mind go, yeah, I did it? And the other part of your mind's going, wait, which is also in the book. Yeah, but look at how you had to do it. So it's kind of but there was no other way I could describe it other than to write what it is. And that was the only way I could think to write it. You know what I'm saying? Just to try, how do I give a description to that which was going on in my mind? And that's how I wrote it.
And part of the description is you allude to what it's like in a deer hunt. And again, I don't want to take it out of context, mm-hmm. but I think you know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. that is something that you said visually you were thinking at the same time everything else was going on.
You know, it's interesting that so the deer part of it comes in this way. So when you read about traumatic experiences and you read about what other people have been through, and again, I only allude to what you read about because your mind, not being a trained psychologist or whatever, your mind tries to normalize the situation by saying, hey, you've been in a situation like this before. You've killed things before. You've killed deer, right? So your mind goes, hey, have I seen this before? You've heard the term, life flashes before your eyes. That's what's going on. That flash, that quick, hey, your mind has to dig back into where you've seen this stuff before. Well, you've seen this stuff before. That's what it is. It's no different than a deer, the blood and everything. And that's the way your mind normalizes it. So when I wrote that part of the book, how do you put it all together? You put it all together just in that perspective.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
I wanted to show other officers and those who wear the badge that, yup, going through a situation like that, there's no joy in it.
Former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez tells us why he decided to publish that book after writing it as a catharsis.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez. As you said, you wrote this as a catharsis. Why did you decide to publish it once it was written?
I decided to publish it because what I realized is from that particular situation and the accumulation of all my career up until that point, I realized that what took place for me is a very rare situation amongst officers. You know, very few officers, there's like 20-some percent of officers will ever pull and discharge their weapon while on duty. So it's not something that happens all the time. And up until that point, you don't really read about it much. You get trained on it some, but most of your trainers will never have gone through anything like that. So when I decided to write and then published, it was more to the point is, hey, man, I realized what just occurred to me. And then, of course, accumulation, because the book didn't come out till way after the situation had happened. And I wanted to show other officers and those who wear the badge that, yep, going through a situation like that, there's no joy in it. There's no fun in it. There's nothing heroic about it. But it happens. Here's what happened to me. Here's how I was able to get over it. And you can too. So I wrote it to help other officers that, God forbid, they ever have to go through something like that.
What was the reaction from the officers who read the book?
Oh, my goodness. Those of my peers who had read it, it gave them a lot of insight that they were like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Because even amongst your peers, they're not quite sure what to say to you. They're not quite sure, you know, because they realize it could be them at any time. And it was very eye-opening and very a sense of relief. And for other officers who have read it, who have been involved in shootings, it gave them a sense of relief from their situation, from the officers that I've talked to.
Did they share with you that they had similar emotions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. A friend of mine wrote a book about officer-involved shootings, and when he read it, he's like, wow, your situation is a lot like other guys' situation. And then, again, the book opened up channels for other officers to talk with me. The book opened up channels for other officers to go seek help before it got to a point of, before they lose it completely, I guess you could say. Because it is a very traumatic situation that happens. So the book has done exactly, I shouldn't say exactly, but the book has done even more than what I would have thought it would.
Did it occur to you when you decided to publish it that there might be people who would read it the wrong way? That it might be painful for people who maybe have lost a loved one in a shooting like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't, you know, the thing is, I can't imagine what anyone would feel to lose a loved one like that. I couldn't. And every situation that a police officer goes through, we see from our vision of we went through it. But we also know that there's another side to all of these situations, no matter what victim it is of a crime that was committed to them or whatever. So when an officer even writes down or even testifies in court, you fully are aware that, yeah, there are other people involved. I intentionally did not, I didn't even put where I work in the book. I intentionally left all of those avenues out because I didn't want it to be anything that had to be so grinding upon a person or to even deliver any more hurt to anyone else. Would people be hurt by it if they read it? I imagine that's on the person who reads it. But for me, I intentionally left names out, things out, other than the officers maybe that had been there, simply because I didn't want it to be anything else to just grind at someone.
I asked you what the response was from police officers who said this was a great book. It really helped. Did you get any criticism from anybody?
Yeah, I mean, there were those who did not like the fact that I had written the book. But like anything else, I mean, there's going to be some who are going to like it and others that are not. But amongst the officers and amongst that profession, I hadn't seen any pushback. Even amongst family members of those who were officers or whatever, I didn't see a lot of negativity. Is there some? Do I see some criticisms? Sure, there's going to be. But that's anything that anyone writes.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
I prayed about it, studied about it, and then I finally made the decision. I said, yep, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it through them.
Former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez explains his decision to become a police chaplain.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez. I'm your host, Libby Collins. When did you make the decision that you wanted to be a chaplain for other police officers?
Let's see, I've been a chaplain now, I think, 2-3 years, probably a little bit before that. Before I retired, I had been looking into that program, and I prayed about it, studied about it. There's a couple different chaplains organizations out there, and then I finally made the decision to, when I read about the Billy Graham program, I said, yep, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it through them.
What was it about the Billy Graham program that drew you to it?
Well, number one, I like the preaching of Billy Graham, but it was the way they went about doing it. Other chaplaincy programs seem to have a generic sense of being a chaplain, whereas the Billy Graham program is, this is a Christian version of being a program, and it hit home to where more, I believe, other chaplaincies are very broad in their chaplaincies. The Billy Graham narrows it down to what I believe in, the way I would like to have been a chaplain. So
what do you do? What missions do you take as a chaplain for the Billy Graham ministry?
So in the Billy Graham Rapid Response Team, again, I don't speak for Billy Graham. I'm a volunteer chaplain through them, so this is in no way I am not speaking for their organization at all. But what the protocol is a lot of times, you know, Samaritan's Purse, you've heard of. Samaritan's Purse will go out to a situation where there's a flooding or, you know, a natural disaster or any kind of disaster. And along with the people from Samaritan's Purse, they'll send this rapid response team chaplaincy. This came about during the World Trade Center when all that happened. And Billy Graham took a look at it and decided to do that. And then the police chaplaincy program sparked from all of that. They realized the unique situation that officers are in, and then they started to train more retired police officers or even on-duty police officers to be chaplains to deal with the situations for cops. And so there's a, lack of a better term, specialty unit, I guess you could say, that they send out. So if there's officer-involved shootings or if there's officer-involved deaths, something that involves officers, school shootings, things like that, they will send officers or former officers to these situations, because when there's trauma going on, cops will open up to other cops.
Why? Why won't they talk to another cop but not to somebody else?
Because it goes back to that brotherhood, that shared experience, right? A cop, when you come on the scene and they know that you've been there, done that, it opens a door. And when that door is opened, as a chaplain, you get to sit and listen to the situations that officers have been in or in that particular time frame. And I can't think of anything more rewarding than to be able to listen and then help mentor and then pray for those officers when you come across those situations.
Do you think you would have been drawn to this ministry if you hadn't been involved in that incident many years ago?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think so. I think eventually I would have been, because that's the type of person I am. But I can tell you what, that situation cemented the need for it.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
In that particular situation, under those particular circumstances, that was the way the situation was going to end.
Former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez answers the question, could he have done anything differently that night?
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with former Kenosha police officer Brian Gonzalez. You know, as you look back at that, 20 years, mm-hmm. more than 20 years, mm-hmm. And it was a man who lost his life while his mother and his sister actually watched it.
Yeah.
There were other family members
who are still grieving, mm-hmm. and you can understand that. And obviously, mm-hmm. your family has gone through a lot as well, mm-hmm. watching what you went through. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, do you think you could have done anything differently that night?
No. I know in that particular situation, under those particular circumstances, that was the way the situation was going to end. That I am assured of.
There's nothing you would have done differently.
No. Not under those circumstances, not under that particular situation. No.
Is there anything that you want to say to the people who were witnesses there that night? The family who watched this, the other people who were nearby?
Oh, I've prayed for them, my goodness, many times to have peace. To have peace. You know, that night before I walked in the door of the building.
Yeah, what building are we talking
about? The police department building. We just say the building. The thought came over me to pray for those two women in particular. And at the time,
This is after the shooting.
After the shooting. I didn't even know who they were. But the thought came to me, pray for those two women because you don't know how they feel. I know how you feel, but you don't know how they feel. Pray that they have peace. And I did. And again, I did then, I do to this day, and because I couldn't even fathom what that would be like.
Have you ever tried to reach out to any of them, to anybody in that family?
At one point, I had gone to the father of the person to let them know that I had forgiven them for what they were doing and in their reactions to what had happened. Because as a person who was grieving, I imagine you go through a series of situations in your mind. And I wanted to just say, hey, I forgive you for the things that you've been saying, the type of things, how you've been putting it. And just understand that what happened that night, I don't go back on it. I can't take it back. How that situation ended was how it was going to end. But I forgive you for the grieving process you're going through and what you're happening to. So, yes.
Did you want them to forgive you? Is that something that you've thought about? Because you did take a life that night of somebody mm-hmm. that they loved and mm-hmm. cared for. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about whether or not they could forgive you?
Forgiveness is something that's given by the person to relieve themselves, not the person who did the occasion. So what I did wasn't anything to be, I guess, forgiven of. I've been saved by the Lord. I took a life under a just circumstance, so I'm not sure if asking for forgiveness is the right thing to do, but to have forgiveness for someone, and this is just my opinion on forgiveness, is to relieve yourself of that which is pressing upon you, I guess you could say. That's the way I view forgiveness.
Someday we're all going to see the Lord.
Yep.
As a chaplain,
yes.
You're looking forward to that day.
Absolutely.
What do you think that would be like? Because obviously this is a huge part of your life, of that incident of that night.
Mm-hmm.
What do you expect when you meet your maker?
Well done, thy good and faithful servant. That's what I'm going to hear. Absolutely. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. Well done, thy good and faithful servant. Because my life isn't deemed into one situation. My life is deemed over a span of time that the Lord has given me to spread his word and to spread his message. So if I were to go out the rest of my life and my only focus was one particular situation, how foolish would that be? The totality of circumstances in my life, the raising of my children, the, you know, marriage I have to my wife, the other people that I've led to the Lord throughout this chaplaincy program, even before that when I was a small child, that accumulation of my life being led by the Holy Spirit is what I'm going to stand before my Maker. And that's why he's going to say to me, well done, thy good and faithful servant.
Brian Gonzalez, thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks.
You have just heard Brian Gonzalez, the former Kenosha police officer who shot and killed Michael Bell Jr. on November 9th, 2004. He shared his interpretation of the events that night and the reason he wrote a self-published book about the incident and its aftermath. If you joined us late and you want to hear this interview in its entirety, or if you missed my conversation with Michael's father and why he still believes not all the facts of the case are known, go to WTMJ.com, where you can hear the perspectives of both Gonzalez and Bell. Then, decide for yourself. Was justice served, or does there need to be more accountability? You'll also find a partial transcript, courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.